Cops in uniform lounged in the cruiser, smoking, tipping the ashes outside the windows. I parked my cruiser outside the tape and put on my rain hat and walked to the shed. She looked at her watch.
Good timing. The coroner will be here earlier than he thought.
This had better be worth it, Detective, I said.
Excuse me?
Giving parts of information over the phone.
You're here, aren't you?
Because I worry about Kevin Penny's child, I said. She looked away, and then back at me, as though making a reevaluation. She had pale skin and lean features like an Indian's, and a mole by the side of her mouth.
Get your latex on and be careful where you step. One of the uniforms puked on the porch.
The body was on the floor, dressed only in sweatpants, the naked stomach white and mottled and bloated like a frog's, the wrists pulled taut above the head and fastened to the floor with toggle bolts. There were pools of black blood under both knees and elbows. The left ear was clogged with blood and brain matter. In the corner was an electric drill matted with spray, the extension cord still plugged in the socket.
Ever see anything like this? Picard said.
Overseas.
Vietnam?
I shook off her question. Who found him?
One of Penny's chippies. He was supposed to take her shopping today.
Why'd you want me over here, Detective?
He and Penny go back.
Not a good choice of words, I said.
He and Cleet Purcell go back.
Cleet tried to help Penny's kid.
Who would you make for this? She said.
For a Vic like this, half the planet.
Let's go outside, she said.
The rain had quit. The swaths of flowers in the field looked like twisted rainbows surrounded by green grass. I wanted to walk among them and keep walking over the edge of the earth. Why were you picking up trash by the shed?
Somebody was eating fried chicken there and throwing the bones on the ground. I don't think it was Penny.
Penny was a slob.
The pond is full of trash, but there's none out here. The chrome and paint on the motorcycle are clean.
Not bad. Cleet's not your guy, I said.
How about you? The word is you might be up on a murder beef.
You must know an Iberia detective named Spade LaBiche.
I try to stay upwind from dog shit, she said.
The coroner's car turned off the asphalt road onto the dirt track that led to the trailer. You need me for anything else? I said.
Nope.
Her mouth formed into a button. That's it?
Yep.
You haven't bagged anything from inside?
Not till the coroner gets here, she said.
There's a gold cigarette lighter in a corner right by the mop.
Yeah, I saw it.
I'd handle it with special care, I said. She looked at me blankly. You might have to get downwind from dog shit after all, I said. Chapter 19. I went to Helen's office and told her what I had seen at Kevin Penny's trailer. I didn't mention the gold lighter. She leaned back in her chair.
You know what this means, don't you?
We lost one guy who could cut me loose on D'Arthez's murder.
Who would have that kind of motivation? She said.
Take your choice.
There's something you are not telling me.
The person who did it is a psychopath. Penny was tortured for reasons of information or revenge that leaves lots of possibilities.
How about Tony Nemo's nematodes? She said.
I think Maximo Souza might be a candidate, I said.
How about Juju?
He does what he's told. She rubbed her forehead. I wanted Penny for the D'Arthez killing. We're going to have trouble with the DA. This stinks. There was a gold cigarette lighter on the floor of Penny's trailer. It took her a second.
Why didn't you say that?
I'm not objective about certain individuals.
Have you seen LaBiche?
In the coffee room.
Tell him to get his ass in here.
That evening I went to an AA meeting in Lafayette. Sometimes AA is a hard sell in South Louisiana. Booze is a big part of the culture. When I was a teenager, nobody was ever carded. Uniformed cops worked as bartenders and in gambling houses in St. Martinville, Lafayette, and Opelousas. The law in Louisiana was never intended to be enforced. Its purpose was to provide a vague guideline that made people feel respectable. New Iberia had the most notorious red light district in the state. There was a semi-cat house and bar right around the corner from the Lafayette Daily Advertiser in the middle of downtown. Friday was family night, no prostitutes allowed. The boiled crawfish and shrimp were free. What better way to give unto Caesar what is Caesar's? Drive-through daiquiri windows are open until 2 a.m. You can get plowed before you go to midnight mass. Fans get wildly drunk at baseball games. If anyone tells you he's from New Orleans and doesn't drink, he's probably not from New Orleans. Louisiana is not a state. It's an outdoor mental asylum in which millions of people stay bombed most of their lives. That's not an exaggeration. Cirrhosis is a family heirloom. The meetings I attend are made up of the bravest people I've ever known. Don't let anyone tell you that only victims of war suffer post-traumatic problems. The unconscious of a recovering drunk is filled with images no one wants to have as part of his spiritual cache. They hit you at a red light, shopping in a grocery, talking to a friend, kneeling in church. There are people in AA who have killed people with their cars or their bare hands. There are people whose negligence killed their children. As I sat in the meeting in Lafayette, I felt dishonest and unworthy. I had owned up to my slip, but not to the possibility that I was involved in a homicide. Nor had I told anyone that the desire to drink was still with me, that pushing a basket down the beer and wine aisle at Winn-Dixie made my throat go dry. A Lutheran minister sat on one side of me, a black hooker on the other. The woman leading the meeting owned a chain of hair salons. Our commonality lay in our addictions and unexplainable chemistry, one that absolutely no one, including us, understands. Though I don't believe in capital punishment, I don't mourn when someone like Penny gets blown out of his socks. However, no one deserves to go out the way he did. When it was my time to speak, I told the group that I was a police officer and had seen an awful instance of inhumanity that morning. I added that when drunk and in a blackout, I may have been guilty of inhumane acts myself. After the Our Father, the hooker told me to have a nice evening. The minister asked if I could give his car battery a jump, and the woman who owned the beauty salons stopped washing coffee cups long enough to throw me a dish towel. As sober drunks say, there are no big deals in AA. Early Tuesday morning, while I was shaving and Allifair was on her jog, someone twisted the bell on the gallery. I walked into the living room and looked through the window screen. Spade LaBiche stood 4 feet away staring at a squirrel on the lawn. I resumed shaving. 2 minutes later, he was at the back door. "What do you want, partner?" I said. "To get something straight. See you in my office." "I know we're not on the best of terms, but I'm going to tell you what I told Helen. You can look at the sign-out sheet. I went to interview Penny. I lost my lighter somewhere. It must have been at his trailer."
"Could be," I said.
"I got a call from Miss Broad in Jennings. She ran my prints. She wants to interview me."
"Sherry Picard?"
"Yeah, that's her name. She sounds like a real cunt."
"You delivered your message, Spade."
"Can't we be friends? Shake hands or something? I shoot off my mouth sometimes."
"No problem. I'll see you later."
"Okay. You got it," he said.
I watched him walk away, obviously confident that he had righted the universe. I wondered how much time would pass before he tried to give it to me between the shoulder blades. That afternoon, I was just leaving my office when Sherry Picard came up the stairs and walked toward me. Her badge holder and a small holstered revolver were hooked on her belt. A pair of cuffs was pulled through the back. Two deputies at the water cooler couldn't take their eyes off her.
Got a minute? She said to me.
Sure, I said. Behind her, one of the deputies pretended to draw two pistols and fire at either me or her. I let her walk ahead of me into my office. I closed the door.
Tell the two needle dicks at the cooler that I heard their comments, she said.
Report them to Sheriff Swallow. She doesn't put up with that kind of thing.
There are no helpful prints inside the trailer, she said.
How about on the fast food trash you picked up by the shed?
They're not in the system.
What did you get off the drill?
The latents aren't in the system.
I twiddled a ballpoint on my deskbed. Why are you here, detective?
The social worker, Carolyn Ardoin, she and Purcell are an item, right?
Anybody who knows Cleet will tell you he's not capable of doing something like this. I won't even discuss it.
Where is he now?
I'm not his keeper.
That's a joke.
She was sitting in front of my desk. She wore starched Cloroxed jeans and a white snap-button western shirt. Her hair was thick and had the same purplish-black sheen in it as Allifair's.
I've seen Purcell's sheet. He has a way of settling scores on his own.
This time I grinned and said nothing. She looked away, her frustration obvious. I suspected she didn't get a lot of support from her peers in Jennings. I'd start with Fat Tony Nemo and a couple of guys named Maximo Souza and Juju Ladrine, I said.
With respect, you don't know shit about this case, Detective Robichaud. Kevin Penny was a confidential informant for the FBI.
How do you know this?
An agent told me. Penny set up his wife's brother. The brother hanged himself in his cell. The agent told me Penny couldn't have cared less.
So maybe Tony Nemo is your guy.
I knew Tony when I was with the St. Bernard Sheriff's Department. He's not stupid enough to torture and kill a federal CI.
What else can I tell you? I said.
Evidently you worked a couple of the Jeff Davis 8 cases, she said.
That's right.
You just shut the drawer on them?
Nobody shuts the drawer on a corpse, particularly a young girl's.
What a laugh.
She got up to go. The two deputies who had made comments about her walked past the door glass. She dropped her business card onto the chair.
I think you're in the right place.
Rather than take overtime pay, I took Wednesday off and went fishing in my boat just north of Marsh Island. The wind was up and a hard chop was slapping the hull and few boats were out. I didn't mind being alone. Solitude and peace with oneself are probably the only preparation one has for death. I put the statement in the third person for a reason. I don't believe I ever achieve these things with any appreciable degree of success. But there are moments when we understand that the earth and the sky and the presences that may lie behind them are always with us. The coastline was a heartbreaking green inside the mist. Flying fish broke from the bay's surface and sailed above the water like pink-gilded winged creatures in defiance of evolutionary probability. The salt spray breaking on my bow was cold and fresh and smelled of resilience and the mysterious powers the earth contains. My boat seemed to float on a cushion of air rising from the same primeval soup that gave birth to the first living creatures. I saw a burnt orange pontoon plane come in low out of a pale yellow sun, the pilot seated in an open cockpit. The plane swooped by, then circled and set down in the chop, blowing water in a huge cloud. The pilot cut the prop and let his plane drift toward me. He pulled up his goggles with his thumb, smearing grease below his eye like the World War I aviator he obviously wanted to be. He threw me a rope. "Hope I didn't chase off your catch," Jimmy Nightingale said. "Lose your way home," I said. "Sheriff Swallow told me where you'd be. Can I come aboard?" He jumped onto the bow without waiting for me to answer. "This is the life. You got any coffee or sandwiches?" I pointed to my cooler. He pulled off the lid. "Man, I love fried chicken," he said. "Fang it down.
He sat on a cushion behind the console and bit into a drumstick. I'm out here to make a confession.
I watched you pitch a number of times, Jimmy. You had a nasty habit.
Like what?
Spitting on baseballs.
Think I'd throw you a slider?
I didn't answer. He began talking about marlin fishing, Washington politics, benchmark oil prices, everything except what was on his mind. Then he said,
maybe I did get it on with her, but it was consensual. I had more to drink than I was willing to admit. We were both out of it. I also happened to have a bowl of Afghan skunk on hand. She probably didn't tell you about that.
You're talking about you and Rowena Broussard?
Who else?
We've gone from denial of rape to denial of any physical contact at all to consensual. It's hard to keep up with you, Jimmy.
It's the truth.
You confess, but you don't confess.
You're right. That's not what's on my mind.
He stared at the water, the tide slapping against the hull.
You saw some bad things in Vietnam?
Can't remember. It's odd. Be honest.
Nope. I'm a total blank on it,
I said.
I did something. I'd like to stick in an envelope and mail to Mars.
I didn't want to be the repository for all the evil in the world. Like Cleet, I had too many videos of my own. They may not have been of my making, but nonetheless I had to carry them. I was determined not to add Jimmy Nightingale's burden to my own.
Take your bullshit somewhere else, I said.
He tossed a chicken bone over his shoulder into the water and wiped his hands on his trousers.
You're going to hear it, whether you like it or not. It was in South America. We were drilling in jungle that was so thick the wind couldn't blow through it. The temperature was 100 degrees at 10 p.m. and the humidity 90%. We all felt like we had ants crawling inside our clothes. The Indians claimed the land was theirs and hung bones in the trees as a warning. When that didn't work, they started shooting arrows at us. We built a wooden shell around the derrick and turned into an oven, maybe 120 degrees. The floor men were fainting or puking in a bucket. We poured water on everybody every half hour. One guy got hit with the tongs. And then a kid took a blow dart in the neck. It had poison on it.
I know where you're going, I said, raising my hand. Don't say any more. He ignored me.
The crew was going to quit. The alternative was to bring in the army. And that meant we'd have them on the payroll. For all I knew, it was the army who stirred up the Indians. What was I supposed to do? Everything was coming apart. There was no reasoning with the Indians. They filed their teeth and mutilated their bodies. The head greaseball said they killed their own children. I had to do something. My father said a leader has to take charge. You save lives when you take charge. That's what he always said.
Jimmy paused in the way people do when they want you to agree with them. I stared at the incoming tide, the orange pontoon plane rocking in the chop, bait fish skittering across the surface as they tried to evade a predator below.
I got a hold of some satchel charges, he said. They were old, maybe, Korean War issue. I didn't know if they'd detonate. I was 22 years old. Another geologist and I flew over the Indian's village. He took the stick and I pulled the cord on the satchels and threw them out the window. And I thought maybe they'd land in the trees and scare the hell out of everybody. I mean, the plane was banking. I wasn't thinking clearly. That's all I wanted to do, scare them. And that's what I was thinking when I got in the plane. Just scare them. I told that to the other geologists. That kid they shot with the blow dart almost died, for Christ's sake.
I reeled in my line and laid my rod across the gunwale. Just off Marsh Island, a sailboat was tacking hard in the wind, waves bursting on the prow. My father used to trap on Marsh Island. He was killed in a blowout on a derrick. Sometimes I would see him standing in the surf, giving me the thumbs-up sign. His hard hat cocked on his forehead.
You're not going to say anything? Jimmy asked.
No.
What?
You think I'm geology's answer to Charlie Manson?
No.
Get off it, Dave. What are you trying to do to me?
What happened to the Indians?
The army went in and cleaned it up.
Cleaned it up?
Took care of the injured or whatever.
Did you go to the village?
I had a deadline. We were down 8,000 feet. We should have hit a pay sand at 5,000. Our investors were shitting their pants.
Answer my question.
The village was on fire. You could see it glowing all night. In the morning, there was a black column of smoke across the jungle for 2 miles. It smelled like garbage burning. Any white person who went down there would have been killed or tied to a tree and had the skin stripped off him.
I unscrewed my thermos and filled the cap with café au lait and drank from it.
I'm sorry I don't have another cup. There's some cold drinks in the ice. A cold drink? Where's your soul?
You've made your statement, Jimmy. My advice is to get rid of the past and get on the square.
I am on the square. That's why I'm running for Senate. I want to do good things for other people. There are people who say I can be president. Look at Clinton and Obama. They came out of nowhere.
You're in with Bobby Earle, I said. When he's no longer useful, you'll throw him out with the coffee grounds. Here's a reminder for you. Mussolini was hanged upside down in a filling station by the same people who elected him.
I'm going to be a dictator?
I shifted my position on the cushion and flung my line baited with shrimp in a high arc over the water. I kept my back to Jimmy Nightingale until I felt the boat wobble as he stepped onto his plane. Then I pulled my anchor and started my twin outboards and headed toward home, eager to see Allifair and Cleet and all the others who represent what is good in the human race.
In my opinion, one of the great follies in the world is to put yourself inside the head of dysfunctional people. The mistake we usually make is to assume there is a rationale for their behavior. In most cases, there is none. Long ago, I came to regard the mob in New Orleans as I would an infected gland. Most of them had the technical skill of hod carriers. They were brutal, stupid to the core, and had the visceral instincts of medieval peasants armed with pitchforks. Their sexual appetites were a hooker's nightmare. The portrayal of them as family men was a joke. They preyed on the weak, corrupted unions, appropriated mom-and-pop stores, and created object lessons with chainsaws and meat hooks. The reinvention of this bunch as Elizabethan men of honor probably would have made Shakespeare and Christopher Marlowe sick. Tony Ninebaugh not only came to New Iberia, his chauffeured Chrysler caught up with Allifair on the paved running track in City Park. He rolled down his tinted window.
How you do, Miss Allifair? I'm Tony Nemo, an associate of your father's.
She thought she was looking at a malignant octopod stuffed into a tailored suit. She sped up and passed the picnic tables and swing sets under the live oaks and circled by the baseball diamond while the Chrysler paced her.
I just want to explain something,
Tony said out the window.
I got the backing for the picture, but I gotta tie it down. Hey, how about listening here, you deaf?
She stopped and breathed slowly. Say it.
Get in. I got coffee. I got beignets. I got cinnamon rolls. I got some chocolates, too.
She had done 3 miles. She wiped the sweat out of her eyes and tried to catch her breath.
Last chance, Mr. Nemo.
I gotta get out of the car. I can't bend over and talk like this. It pinches off my pipes.
His driver helped him out and walked him to a picnic table. Tony collapsed on the bench, wheezing.
These guys in Hollywood say I gotta get the option. It ain't enough to use a historical story. Levon Broussard told me to get lost. That a local person is already doing the treatment. So who's that local person gotta be?
I don't have control of the option, Mr. Nemo. I was doing an outline for fun.
Nobody does anything for nothing in the film business. Look, come in with me on this deal. I checked you out. You're already in the Screenwriters Guild. The state of Louisiana pays up to 25% in tax exemptions and subsidies for films that get made here. We put some locals in Confederate uniforms and hire a boxcar load of boons, and we're in business.
When she didn't answer, he looked her up and down.
I'm not supposed to say boons. They call each other niggers.
The answer is no.
Union minimum for a treatment is what, 22 grand? That's for 10 pages. I'll write you a check now.
Sorry.
How much you want?
Talk to Levon.
He won't talk. That's why I'm here.
He began coughing and spat a wad of phlegm between his legs. He wiped his mouth with a lavender monogrammed handkerchief. His face was dilated, his eyes as big as oysters.
I'm going to have a heart attack here.
Levon doesn't think Civil War adaptations have a future.
He's a snob, and sour grapes is what he is,
Tony said.
I ain't a bad man, no matter what everybody says. I didn't invent the rules. I go by the rules. I'm a ruthless son of a bitch who always keeps his word. You could do worse in this business.
He began choking again, the handkerchief pressed to his mouth, his face turning purple. His driver spread his gloved hand on Nemo's back.
You better take him to Iberia General, Alfair said.
Tony waved weakly at the air.
I want you on that script. You've got balls.
I've got what?
Balls. You got balls.
He said, his voice hardly more than a whisper. She wondered how so many people could be afraid of such a sick man. The driver held an oxygen cup to Tony's face.
I hope you're better, Mr. Nemo, Alifair said.
Then she jogged across the green toward the drawbridge at Burke Street, her tanned legs flashing in the sunlight.
Chapter 20. She didn't tell me about her encounter with Tony until that evening.
Why didn't you say anything earlier, Alf? I said.
You were at work. He's a pitiful man. I think we should feel sorry for him.
Don't tell Cleet Purcell that.
You should have seen him.
Tony Nemo should have been sent to a rendering plant a long time ago.
Pretty callous, Dave.
I feel as bad about that as I can. But you can't get mad at your daughter because she's compassionate, even if you think her feelings are misdirected.
I called Levon's house. Rowena answered. Could I speak to Levon, please? I said.
What for?
It's of a personal nature.
How's this for personal? Why don't you do your job and leave us alone?
Where is he, Ms. Broussard?
He just went out the door. With his favorite shotgun. Maybe you can catch him.
When I got to the Broussard home, I heard the popping sounds of gunfire from behind the house. It was twilight, the yard deep in shadow, the sky marbled with purple and red clouds. I skirted the house and came out in the backyard. Levon was firing with 12-gauge at clay pigeons he'd launched from an automatic trap thrower, bursting them above Bayou Teche, regardless of the neighbors on the far side of the water. He took the plugs out of his ears. He was wearing a sleeveless shooting jacket stuffed with shells. His face seemed thinner. His eyes receded, the color of buckshot.
Slumming? He asked.
I need a lesson or two about film rights and such. Tony Nemo is on Alifair's case.
About what?
He wants her to write a screenplay or adaptation or whatever you call it, based on your novel.
I've heard from my agent and a couple of producers. This character has been pestering. Evidently you stoked him up.
I told him he could create a historical piece that wasn't dependent on your novel.
Thanks a lot for doing that, Levon said.
He says these guys in Hollywood actually want to go into business with him.
They probably do. Nemo is wired into the entirety of the casino culture. He knows how to get around the unions. He launders money. Hollywood is Babylon by the sea. He's a perfect fit.
According to Allifair, period pieces are dead on arrival.
Now they are.
But someday?
What do I know? I don't care, either.
What writer wouldn't want to see his work on the screen? I said.
J.D. Salinger?
Salinger didn't like to see people, either. That's why he put his name on his mailbox out on the road.
You want to shoot? He asked.
No. He ejected the spent shell from the chamber and began thumbing 5 fresh rounds into the magazine.
You don't keep a sportsman plug in the magazine, I said. I don't have to. I don't hunt. I shoot on the clay targets.
He rested the shotgun in the crook of his arm. You don't look the same, I said.
What? Everything copacetic? I'm not the issue. Rowena is.
I'm sorry all this has happened to you, Levon.
Actually, I'm surprised you're here. You must not have seen the local news this evening, he said. You were the lead story. I don't mean to be the bearer of bad news.
At 10 p.m., Allifair and I watched the replay of the interview with T.J. D'Arthez's wife. It was hard. Her grief and incomprehension were real. All of her features were round, without corners or angles, her face without makeup. A pie plate full of dough. Her husband was dead, killed, she said, by someone in the Iberia Parish Sheriff's Department, a man who had harassed both her and her husband. She had no income and was about to be evicted from the quarters outside Lauraville. Allifair started to turn off the set. Let's hear her out, I said. Mrs. D'Arthez was crying, her handkerchief twisted between her fingers. The interview had been prefaced with the caption, "Justice denied?" The newsman was obviously moved and had trouble completing the interview. He thanked her for being there, then looked silently at the camera. "Someone is doing a job on you, Dave," Allifair said. "Nobody has that kind of beef against me." "Labiche does. He's not that smart. At this point, you should get a lawyer. A lawyer will tell me to shut up and not cooperate with the department. Everything I do will be interpreted as an indicator of guilt." She couldn't argue with that one. I had been in the midst of Katrina and its aftermath. Oddly, I wanted to return to those days. There is a purity in catastrophe. We see firsthand the nature of both human courage and human frailty, the destructive and arbitrary power of the elements. The breakdown of social restraint in our mechanical inventions and the release of the savage that hides in the collective unconscious. An emergency room lit only by flashlights and filled with the moans of the dying and feet sloshing in water becomes a medieval scene no different than one penned by Victor Hugo. It is under these circumstances that we discover who we are, for good or bad, and when all this passes, we never talk about it, lest we lose the insight it gave us. Wars have the same attraction. Rhetoric fades away. Truth remains. In my hometown, I was trapped by shadows that had neither substance nor face. Helen called me in the next morning. "I just got back from the prosecutor's office." "He watched the news last night," I said. "The wire services and networks are on him. I've had 3 calls myself."
"I see. Internal affairs is taking over." "Internal affairs is a joke," I said. "Let me put you on the desk. All this will pass."
"Not for me, it won't. Maybe I killed D'Arthez. I have dreams I can't remember. I think he's in them. I see headlights shining and hear glass breaking. I see blood coming from someone's mouth." It was obvious that she didn't want to hear it. "We have a witness who puts Kevin Penny at the scene," she said. "That's reasonable doubt. The prosecutor knows this isn't a prosecutable case."
"Then why doesn't he say that?"
At some point, all of us will. Then a shitload of criticism will come down on our heads, and time will go by, and everybody will forget it. She was dead wrong, but I let it go. Tony Nemo's in town. Tony Nineball is in New Iberia? He wants Alifair to do a film adaptation of Levon Broussard's Civil War novel. Lucky her. I went to see Levon about it. He talked about his wife's suicide attempt and her depression. I expected him to say something about Jimmy Nightingale not being under arrest. So? I thought it was kind of funny, that's all. If I ever saw an instance of Southern inbreeding as that guy, she said, the day Levon Broussard makes sense to you is the day you should have yourself lobotomized. Cleet had brought home a penny to New Iberia and placed him during the day with a Creole woman in an Acadian cottage on the road to St. Martinville. According to legend, it was built in the late 18th century and was the oldest structure in the parish. Each morning she took him to school, and each afternoon he rode the school bus back to the cottage where Cleet picked him up at 5. In the meantime, Cleet visited Carolyn Ardoin at her home in Jennings and brought her flowers and candy and baskets of fruit and books from the library, his heart emptying out each time he looked at the damage that her assailant or assailants had done to her. He also launched his own investigation into the attack, starting with Pookie the Possum Domingue. Cleet found him early in the day in an upscale billiard hall in Lafayette, one that had a bar and a mixologist and rows of beautifully maintained tables. Pookie was shooting a game of rotation by himself. He wore an expensive oversized suit and a loud tie and tasseled loafers and a crisp shirt with cufflinks. His pointy face shrank when he saw Cleet walking toward him.
"Know who Carolyn Ardoin is?" Cleet said.
"Maybe I heard the name," Pookie said.
"Wrong answer. She's my lady friend. Know what happened to her?"
Pookie rested the butt of his cue on the floor. He looked at the people drinking and eating at the bar. The free lunch that day was chipped beef poured on crushed beignets. A bowl of it sat on a chair by Pookie's pool table. It looked like cat puke.
"Want me to ask you again?" Cleet said.
"There's a shutdown on information in that area."
"Because of Kevin Penny?"
"Cooling, huh?"
"Who did him?"
"I don't know, Purcell. I don't want to know."
"Who attacked Miss Carolyn?"
"I warned you about Maximo and Juju."
"Tony sicked them on Miss Carolyn?"
"I ain't said that. You don't get it. It's the dope, man. That's what all this is about."
"The stuff coming in off I-10?
"It comes from everywhere. There's legal marijuana farms in Puerto Rico now. The meth labs are gonna take a hit. You know the drugs you can buy in any schoolyard in the state?"
"I don't care about that," Cleet said.
"Nobody does. That's why guys like Tony the Nose are happy. You might pass that on to Braun and the Jeff Davis Sheriff's Department dresses like she's at the rodeo."
"Sherry Picard?" Cleet said.
"Yeah, the one that's got a nose in the air. Here's the word. Stay out of Jeff Davis Parish. Don't mess with any of Tony Squid's people. People should forget any rumors about Jimmy Nightingale."
"Nightingale is a great guy," Cleet said.
"He slept with some of those dead girls."
"One of the Jeff Davis 8?
"I ain't saying no more."
"What if I spread it around as you've been shooting off your mouth? I might end up being your only friend, Pookie. Give that some thought."
Pookie's skin turned as gray as a dehydrated lizard's, his eyes as tiny as seeds.
"This ain't right, no. I always helped you out, Purcell."
"Then do it now. There's at least one guy out there who needs to go off the board. Dave Robichaux saw Penny's body. The man's feet were bolted to the floor. The guy who did him took his time, then pushed an electric drill through his eardrum into his brain. Somebody power broke a tight rack, spilling 2 or 3 balls onto the floor." Pookie sat down on a felt-covered bench and picked up his bowl of chipped beef and started spooning it into his mouth as though it were wet confetti. He gagged and spat it back in the bowl.
I can't take this. I gotta get out of town.
Tell me what you know.
I don't know nothing. That's the point. Ain't nobody gonna believe me either. Nobody got my back.
Cleet went to the bar and bought two long necks. He sat down next to Pookie and handed him one. Guys like us are old school. Drink up and quit worrying, Pook. We're not that important to anybody.
Think so?
You bet, Cleet said, taking a swig. Words he would regret. On Friday morning, I began gathering my notes and writing my conclusions regarding the sexual assault on the person of Rowena Broussard. In many ways, the difficulty lay in the recalcitrant and illogical and contradictory statements and behavior of the accuser. She had not gone to a hospital, nor had she called the authorities or asked for a rape kit. Instead, she had showered and destroyed any chance of the prosecution using the kind of forensic evidence that people have learned about from television shows. She had been impaired when the attack took place, if indeed it took place. A pillowcase had been pulled over her head, intensifying her pain and fear, but leaving her descriptions muddled. The bruising on her body could have been caused by a fall outside the lounge where she had gotten drunk with the accused. She said she had been raped by two men in Wichita, Kansas, but the prosecutor had dropped the charges for political reasons. It was possible she had transferred her rage at the injustice done her in Kansas to her current situation in New Iberia. It happens. The family physician had indicated that she may have been a neglected wife. Hell hath no fury, he had said. Jimmy Nightingale was a conundrum as well. He had claimed he never touched Rowena except to pick her up when she fell in the parking lot. Then he had indicated he may have had a consensual experience with her, but he could remember no details. He had said they were both swacked out of their minds on hashish and alcohol, which I believed. Other than that, I knew little more than I did when the investigation began. I've seen cops write off this kind of situation as he said, she said. That's the cliché they use. When we see it in print or in an interdepartmental email, it means the woman is about to get it in the neck. Why? The situation is not equal. The woman has to prove the existence of an act nobody other than the perpetrator was witness to. Perhaps a year will pass before the case goes to trial. In the meantime, she has to give depositions in front of strangers, accept lewd stares in a courthouse hallway, the hidden smirk in the face of a redneck cop, the muffled laughter among a group of males as she walks by. I once heard a Lafayette cop in the bullpen, right by the dispatcher's cage, tell his colleagues about a man who held a woman down and rubbed his penis all over her body. He thought the story was hilarious. In my summation, I said, I believe the scratches on Rowena's hip, the bruise inside her thigh, the bite mark on her shoulder, and the obvious emotional and psychological trauma visited upon her were consistent with her claim, namely, that while she was impaired, she was raped and probably orally sodomized by James Buford Nightingale. I also believed she'd showered and hadn't told her husband about the assault immediately because she was ashamed and felt her drunken state had invited the attack. What I couldn't put in my report was my dismay at Nightingale's attitude. He was obsessed with guilt for air-bombing the Indians, but cavalier about the possibility that he had raped Rowena Broussard in a blackout. Regardless, I did the best I could with the information I had, and I emailed it to Helen's computer. 10 minutes later, she opened my door and leaned inside. Way to rock, Pappy. On Tuesday, Jimmy was formally charged. With an attorney by his side, he surrendered at the courthouse, and in under 2 hours, he was fingerprinted and released on $25,000 bail. That evening, he gave an interview to 3 local television stations in his backyard. He was dressed in golf slacks and a polo shirt and seated by a reflecting pool blanketed with floating camellias. His skin was pink in the sunset, his bronze hair freshly barbered, his expression both calm and humble. Just as the interview began,
He set aside a book he had been reading, one that looked like a Bible. His diction was perfect, his accent like the recorded voice of William Faulkner or Robert Penn Warren or Walker Percy. You felt he could recite from the telephone directory and turn it into the Sermon on the Mount. "I'm disappointed and disturbed by the conduct of some of our officials," he said. "I bear them no ill will, but I believe a small group of individuals have acted politically and done a disservice to their constituency. I promise to be as forthcoming as I possibly can. I love the state of Louisiana, and I love its people. I would never lie to them, not now, not in the past, not in the future. I say this before the throne of God." He gazed at the scarlet reflection of the bayou and the moss-hung boughs of the live oaks, his face as chiseled and noble as Robert E. Lee's at Appomattox. No one could say Jimmy Nightingale didn't have the touch. Chapter 21. The man who got on the flight from Miami to New Orleans and took a seat next to a huge black woman whose rolls of fat seemed to drip into the aisle, wore Bermuda shorts, red tennis shoes, a canary yellow t-shirt with Mickey Mouse's face on it, and big round sunglasses that were as black as welder's goggles. His skin was the color of powdered milk, his hair like wisps of corn silk on a doll's head, his smile a slice of watermelon. He stepped on the black woman's foot, tumbled across her body with his drawstring beach bag, and smashed his head on the window. "Owie," he said. "Are you hurt?" the black woman said. "Not much," he said, pressing his hand against the red knot on his forehead. He gathered up his sunglasses. "I hope I didn't hurt your foot too bad." "I've been reading my Thought of the Day book. I don't let nothing bother me."
"My name is Chester Wimple. What's yours?"
"Birdie."
"It's nice to meet you, Miss Birdie."
He took two unpeeled peaches from his beach bag and gave one to her and began sucking on the other like a child finding a teat.
"Sometimes people call me Smiley. I can speak Spanish."
She couldn't quite put the two statements together. "Smiley is a very nice name."
"I have a lisp. People think it's because I'm from New Orleans. It's because I had a cleft palate that had to be operated on when I was little."
"Don't let nobody be telling you your voice ain't nice. It's nice." He flipped down the table on the back of the seat in front of him.
"Do you like checkers?"
"Our church group plays checkers and Monopoly at the old people's home every Sunday night."
"I love Monopoly," he said.
He pushed back in the seat with the thrust of the plane, his face filled with delight, then felt the plane level off and catch hold of the clouds. He could see the city disappearing behind him in the twilight, the condos and palm trees and waves on Miami Beach miniaturizing, the way every stage of his life seemed to shrink and diminish into nothingness whenever he decided to move on to his next adventure. He did not understand why people had trouble with life. Every so often, you got on a plane and flew away and let whatever was wrong with that place correct itself. Even the Everglades were shrinking into a tiny pattern of green islands and brown canals and bays that looked like a map rather than a watershed. Distance allowed you to sort things out. Otherwise, there was too much confusion, too many voices bouncing around in your head, too many people who needed correcting. He opened his folding checkerboard and set out the checkers for his new friend and himself.
"You're a lady, though you go first."
Shortly, as though in a dream, the sun was gone. The sky blew black as they approached the Louis Armstrong Airport. Chester could see Lake Pontchartrain and headlights streaming across the causeway, the Mississippi winding in serpentine fashion through the wetlands, Algiers shrouded in mist across the river, the revelers dancing in the streets of the French Quarter, as though none of them had to die, the Garden District and Tulane and Loyola Universities up St. Charles Avenue, all of it streaking past him, about to become real and not as much fun as it was up here. He took a pad from his shirt pocket and wrote on the top page and tore it off and handed it to Bertie.
"That's my number. If you ever have any trouble, call me."
He always had difficulties with his R's, and trouble came out as twubble. Bertie looked at the blinking sign above the captain's cabin and buckled her seatbelt.
"You have been very courteous to me, Smiley. I'm not fond of flying, but with you, I didn't feel no fear. Your father probably was no good, but your mama was." "How do you know that?" he said. "Women know these things."
Inside the airport, he retrieved his small wheelie bag and rolled it next to Bertie out the door to the cab stand, which was located in a car tunnel under the building. Two black guys, maybe 19 or 20 years old, locked on to Bertie and Chester as soon as they saw them, the way schoolyard and sidewalk bullies always recognize the weak and the vulnerable, the halt and the lame, those born ugly or fat or mentally handicapped or misshapen, those who somehow seemed deserving of torment. They were probably stealing luggage or shagging change or maybe shagging a country girl new to the city. They were a classic pair, sneering, loud, stupid, cruel, born of a single mother, detested in the womb, raised on welfare, smelling of funk and pomade and rut, users of their roles as victims to cause scenes when confronted with their abuse. They were both chewing gum, smacking it, their eyes bright, the unpredictable glaze you saw in the eyes of meth heads.
"Here come Aunt Jemima and the Pillsbury Doughboy,"
the taller one said. He had one gold tooth and one missing tooth. "Shut your mouth, boy," Bertie said.
"Big Mama speaks," the other guy said.
His pants were so low his pubic hair was showing.
"Got her jelly roll ready to rock."
"I'll slap your face," she said. He responded by tripping Chester.
"Sorry there, boss. Help massa with your bag."
Chester got up from the concrete, Bertie's face like a hurt child's. The taller guy was chewing his gum, rapidly grinning.
"Go on, man. We didn't mean nothing. Hey, you listening? Get the fuck out of here."
Chester opened the back door of a taxi and helped Bertie in. She looked up at him, a dignified church woman who had probably spent a large part of her life forgiving other people.
"We can share the ride if you go in there gently."
He shut the door and patted the top of her hand when she placed it on the windowsill.
"I got to take care of some business that came up all of a sudden."
"You stay out of trouble."
"Yes, ma'am. I love you, Miss Bertie."
The cab drove away. Chester stood among the crowd on the pavement, the arc lights burning overhead, his knees scraped from the fall. He watched the two black guys walk away and get into an old Honda in the parking lot. Chester grabbed the next taxi in line, one driven by an Arab who had turned his cab into a bead-strung mosque that smelled of burning incense and was filled with yowling sounds.
"My name is Chester. What's yours?"
"Mohammed," the driver said.
"Do you see those two black boys?"
"I see them, sir."
"They're friends of mine. I want to go where they go."
The driver turned all the way around to get a full look at his passenger. He had a beard like shaggy black rope wrapped under his nose and scrolled on his cheeks.
"I have seen those two men before. They are not good young men, sir."
"They're bad?"
"They are very bad."
"They shouldn't be acting like that,"
Chester said.
"I'll tell them."
The driver started the meter and drove onto I-10 not far behind the Honda. They crossed the river into Algiers and continued into a neighborhood of empty buildings, alleys oozing trash, bars on windows, rap music blaring from a club, hookers strolling under the neon. Up ahead, the Honda pulled into the gravel drive of a darkened frame house built up from the street. There were no lights inside.
"Let me out," Chester said.
Maybe you should let me take you somewhere else, sir, the driver said.
This is as far as I go. How much is the fare?
$28.
Chester got out and paid the driver through the window. He added a $5 tip.
I like your music.
Thank you, sir, the driver said. God is good.
Chester squinted to show that he didn't understand.
Be careful, sir, the driver said.
There are evil men in the world.
Chester watched the taxi drive away, then began wheeling his bag down the broken sidewalk toward the elevated house. Someone had turned on a light in back, and he saw a shadow move across the kitchen window. There were no street lamps on the block. He pulled his bag between two cars whose engines had been stripped, and unlocked and unzipped his wheelie bag, and removed a nickel-plated snub-nosed .357 Magnum from the gun case inside the bag. He walked up the steps of the house, set down his beach bag, and rested his wheelie against the wall, then worked on a pair of thin cotton gloves. The screen and inside door were unlocked. He stepped inside and walked through the living room and into the hallway. The two black guys were eating out of cans at the kitchen table, their cigarettes burning in an ashtray, quart bottles of beer by their elbows.
Hi again. My name is Chester. You hurt my knees and made fun of Miss Burley.
How the fuck? The taller guy began.
A taxi. Some people call me Smiley. Know why?
They stared at the revolver in his hand and shook their heads. No, one of them said, so frightened that his mouth did not move, and Chester could not tell which one had spoken.
I like children. They make me happy, Chester said.
You were very bad.
We didn't mean nothing, the shorter one said. There was dried food on his bottom lip. His fork was trembling on top of an open tuna can.
Say you're sorry.
Sure, man, the tall one said, as though he had been released from a bathysphere. Sit down. You want a beer? He raked back a chair, his face popping sweat.
You didn't say it like you meant it, Chester said.
We mean it, man. Come on, man, don't point that at me, please.
Just as lightning crashed into someone's yard, Chester shot each of them, one through the throat, one through the chest. They were still alive when he stood over them and shot them again. Then he sprinkled their uneaten food in their faces and turned off the light and retrieved his beach bag and travel case and went out the back door. A soft rain was falling, the clouds flickering. Thunder rolling dully across the wetlands. The wheels on his bag clicked monotonously down the broken sidewalks, past the abandoned buildings that were probably shooting galleries, past the club that shook with rap music. The hookers had gone inside out of the rain. He stared through the window at the people inside and smiled at the way they danced and seemed to enjoy themselves. The neon glow of the club slid off his body like dissolving watercolor. See, he thought. Life wasn't complicated at all. In a minute he would be gone, subsumed inside the great American night, a tiny point of light inside a galaxy that became a snowy road arching into infinity. He tilted back his head and let the rain fall into his mouth. He licked the drops off his lips as he would sprinkles on ice cream. Cleet had gone home for lunch. Homer was at private school in the little town of Cade on the other side of Spanish Lake. Cleet had begun splitting a loaf of warm French bread to make a po' boy sandwich when he looked out the window and saw the police cruiser turn into the motor court and stop in front of his cottage. A woman was behind the wheel. The cruiser had dents and scratches on it, and one headlight hung lower than the other. It was the kind of vehicle that law enforcement agencies often issued to minority members years ago. A tall brunette woman in jeans and a white shirt and unshined western boots got out and knocked on the door. Cleet looked around the room. Homer's baseball bat and glove were on a chair. He threw his raincoat over them and opened the door.
Detective Sherry Picard, she said. I need a few minutes of your time.
I'm about to eat.
Put it on hold. She stepped in.